All lines are muted.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the task force meeting. There's lots to cover, so let's get started, and I'll begin by taking roll. John Tansky?
Here.
Arianne Malik?
Good morning and or afternoon.
Yes. Carolyn?
I'm here.
Aaron Mary?
Aaron Mary, here.
Aaron, sorry. Thank you. Sherilyn Turney?
Cheryl's here.
Thank you. Sasha Termont?
Here.
Steve Reedy? Cynthia Fisher? Emil Jane? Andrew Trescott? Denise Webb? David McCauley?
Here.
Thank you. Mark Savage?
Good morning, here, and I have a question when you're finished with the roll call.
Gotcha. Norm Ox? Grace Terrell?
Here.
And Laura Kahn?
Here.
Great, thank you. Zoe, Norm, what's your question? I forgot.
It was Mark with a question, and I'm noticing the agenda up on the meeting presentation, which doesn't look like the agenda that was in the slide deck for today, and just
we just changed that, so I'll throw it to Zoe so she could get us started.
Oh, actually, why don't I throw it to Arianne so he can give the overview.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. So, I think people have noticed, at least I've noticed, that we have not made as much progress as a task force as we did last time. That's primarily due to the whole set of other activities that we all have going on, including the information blocking task force and the associated HITECH meetings, where we were able to finalize the information blocking task force recommendations. And we just haven't had the ability to dedicate time, energy, and attention to the TEF. Since we've gotten through our Cures NPRM recommendations, we're now in a period where we can dedicate more time to the TEFCA2 task force. But I think we also need to recognize that we're behind where we expected to be, and we're at risk relative to being able to make recommendations to ONC prior to the comment close period. We may have to ask for an extension or allowance for that. What we're recommending at this point is, rather than do a deep dive on every topic, we want to make sure that we touch at least everything that's in our agenda for the TEF once at a fairly high level, and tag and note any topics that we think warrant additional follow-up discussion. We're going to try to get through those remaining items, particularly in privacy and security, today. And then tomorrow, the approach is to prioritize the work of the task force against the highest priority needs that require comments. So we've already heard from the discussion a whole set of items that warrant future discussion and future follow-up. Rather than go deep on them in this meeting, our proposal is to touch privacy and security, make sure that we're tagging anything that warrants additional follow-up, and then create a prioritized list of items for deep discussion starting tomorrow. So I'm just going to pause there. John, if you have anything to add to that overview of our suggested approach, A and B, any of the task force members confused by where we are or hopefully accepting of the direction that we're proposing going in.
So this is John. In other words, we're going to get try and overview topics today. Raise your hand as you have interest in saying, I want to talk about X and dive into X more deeply, which we will put on a list of items to prioritize for diving into on future calls. So rather than having big discussion today, raise your hand and note the topic that you want to nominate for discussion, if that makes sense. Comments, please.
This is Mark. Makes sense to me. Just a question. That will also include things that have already come up in the past, right? We don't need to re-raise them?
Yep.
Thank you.
No, you may need to re-raise them. So we'll try to summarize what we think we heard from the task force, and you may want to add other things to that list. But we're going to try to do our homework and make sure that we tag the most important items for a follow-up discussion. And so with that, I think we want to turn it back over to Zoe and to Catherine.
Yeah, perfect. So I'm going to do a brief overview of some of the privacy provisions, and then I'm going to turn it to Alex Contour, who's going to do an overview of security. And Catherine, please feel free to jump in or add color or anything you wish as we go through this stuff. And we're going to do it at a pretty high level. So first I want to say with the privacy and security sections, just want to level set for everyone's understanding a little bit. The way that we drafted the privacy and security sections was to align with and complement applicable law, particularly the HIPAA privacy and security rules, as much as possible. So the MRTCs are written with the assumption that everybody who is a covered entity or a business associate is currently following the HIPAA privacy and security rule. We go above and beyond then to say that QHINs, regardless of whether or not they are covered entities or business associates, must comply with the HIPAA privacy and security rules as if it applies to all electronic health information. That's another little nuance there, the applying to all electronic health information, because what you'll notice is that the provisions that we've either, you know, mirrored from HIPAA or where we've pointed directly to HIPAA, but we've actually, you know, written them out in the MRTCs themselves. We do that because we want to apply those provisions to all electronic health information, unless we say otherwise. Also, a lot of the references that we make that where we point directly to HIPAA is because we are expanding the requirements to apply to all participating entities in the TEFCA environment, again, which would include non-covered entities and non-business associates. And there are certain exceptions in there. And actually, so one exception that I want to note right off the bat is that there's an exception for federal agencies who currently do not have to follow HIPAA and they are following their own applicable law. So an example of that is the Social Security Administration. They follow, you know, their own applicable privacy and security requirements, and they would not have to follow any of the HIPAA requirements that we have put into the MRTC. Okay, so with that being said, go ahead.
Zoe, sorry, I want to ask a question or just make sure what I think I understand is that in most cases a HIN or QHIN would already be a business associate and already transacting data on behalf of a covered entity. And in those cases, compliance with HIPAA would be required. There are cases where a HIN may well be transacting data on behalf of a non-covered entity. And the intent of structuring it the way that the TEF does is to make sure that there's no ambiguity. that everybody's basically holding against the same baseline rules.
Yes, that's a really, and that's a really good way of framing it, Arian. Thank you. And you'll notice we don't put the entire HIPAA privacy and security rule in here, right? So participants and participant members who are non-covered entities and business associates, they don't have to do everything in HIPAA, but we have very carefully chosen specific things that we do think are, you know, highly important in order to protect the privacy and security of the information. So one of the broader things that we're looking for comment from the task force is, you know, first of all, our approach in how we've done this. And second of all, if the sections that we've pulled from HIPAA, if those, are those the right requirements? Are those the right provisions? You know, is there something that we're missing or something that you think would be too burdensome to put on those non-HIPAA entities? We're trying to achieve the right balance between protecting the privacy and security of the information that flows through the network, but still expanding the access of health information for all patients and providers.
And Zoe, it's John, just to confirm, it's comply with the HIPAA rules that are called out as if they applied to EHI, true?
Correct, yes. Go ahead.
It's David. Just a quick comment. I think that some of the entities that would like to participate in this ecosystem would currently be regulated under Federal Trade Commission rules, and the industry has adopted this sort of notion that either you're under HIPAA or you're under FTC, and depends on which, the rules are different. It would be useful as we go forward to clarify those boundary conditions here and which actors are under HIPAA and which actors are under FTC, if that still makes sense.
Absolutely.
Is that the first candidate for our list?
Sorry, are other people hearing an echo when I talk?
Yes.
A little bit.
This is Mark, yes.
Yeah, so if you're not actively speaking, please go on mute. Maybe that'll help.
I'm sorry, I was just asking if David's question goes on the list of our approach.
Yes.
Okay, so if we could just make sure to capture that question in the notes, that would be great.
And I think we've already captured the role of patient intermediaries. That was an item that came up last time in our recommendations, and I think it's an item that'll come up for discussion this time as well. So if you're worried about patient intermediaries, rest assured that we'll have time to discuss those points.
Okay, great. So if we move to the next slide.
So, this is Mark. Can I just throw in a question? To Arian's example of that HINs, QNs may already be business associates, but we're also talking about situations where somebody, there may not be a relationship and they must act as if HIPAA applies. There are some differences between covered entities and business associates. What role do they have to act as if?
They have to act according to the HIPAA, the provisions that were lifted from HIPAA that apply to QHINs independent of their status. And I think we're going to go through those provisions in the rest of the conversation.
Very good. Thank you.
And as I said, I think as Zoe framed up, we want to make sure that the provisions that were lifted are the right provisions. And then Zoe, just to be clear, and Catherine as well, you know, my assumption would be this is not preemptive, that if I'm already a covered entity or already a business associate and covered by BA terms from my covered entities, those terms would still apply. This is really just covering the cases where nothing else applies.
That's right, Arian. And we in fact, in some of the provisions, we actually spell that out and say, you know, this does not supplant your requirement, you know, to do a notice of privacy practices, for example. But sometimes we do also say that if they satisfy the requirement through HIPAA, then that could serve as satisfying the requirement from the MRTC. But in terms of, like, governance, the RCE is going to be the one ensuring the compliance with the MRTCs, not the, you know, how it's done through HIPAA. But that's definitely something, I mean, that's something that I think that I would also say is on the table for discussion a little bit. So if there is conversation, you know, about how that might work or in which cases, you know, anything like that, I think would be helpful to talk about. So.
And this is Catherine. Thanks for that, Zoe. I mean, the only thing I would add for consideration is to the extent this agreement or the TEFCA broader discussion would be impacting or somewhat the appearance of disruptive to how things are currently occurring through business associate agreements, that would be helpful to understand as we look forward to the future.
Great. Thank you. Okay, so the first topic to review is the concept of minimum information, and we brought this up briefly on the last call, and it's particularly applicable to sections 2.2.2, 7.2, and 8.2, which deal with the permitted and future uses of EHI. And so basically we say that once EHI is received by a QHIM participant or participant member, they can retain, aggregate, use, and disclose the EHI for anything that the individual has given explicit approval for, but only if the individual has received the minimum information about what is going to happen with their data. So the idea here was that we wanted patients to not just receive like a notice or a summary saying that their data was going to be, you know, used by, in some way, but we wanted them to actually have, you know, the meaningful ability to say, yes, I want my data to be used in that way, or no, I don't. And we wanted, you know, that to come across in an accessible and understandable way. So these are the items that we believe should be included in the minimum information when requesting patient consent to use their data for a way that's not one of the exchange purposes that we've, you know, explicitly stated in the MRTCs. And it needs to include items such as the person or entity that will be, you know, taking the, any action with the data, the specific purposes for which the action may be taken, how long, whether the EHI may be disclosed to any third party, and if so, to whom and for what purpose, whether it may be used by a third party and identify the third party in the uses, whether the QHIM participant, participant member, and any third party may disclose the EHI, or sorry, and any third party to which any of them may disclose the EHI, whether the EHI may be sold or licensed, any material benefits or risks of such action, and whether the privacy and security measures set forth in the MRTCs will apply to the EHI that is the subject of such action. We also, at the bottom, we say that for purposes of this definition, they can't send a notice in all capital letters to satisfy the requirement that the minimum information be conspicuous. And that's something that we've seen done in the past and don't believe is sufficient in order to make, you know, this information conspicuous and accessible to the patient.
These are provisions that apply to the individual. Oh, go ahead, David. Sorry.
Well, that was going to be my question. Is I'm not exactly sure who this applies to in terms of the standard permitted purposes versus, is this just for individual access outside of the standard permitted purposes? So, Zoe, who is required to provide this to the individual and when?
So whoever, whether it's the QHIN participant or participant member, that's the recipient of the data. If they want to do anything with that data, that's not one of the exchange purposes that we have listed in the MRTC. So if they want to use it for research or some other, you know, something else that's not part of the MRTCs, those seven exchange purposes, then they would have to send this notice to the individual who's the subject of the information, getting their consent.
So Zoe, So this may be worthy of going on the list for discussion. I was interested in some clarification. It may apply to, it's definitely 2.2.2, and the difference between sub-bullet 5 and 6, 6 being the one that says anything else you want to do as long as you tell the individual minimum information, et cetera, but 5 being you can do anything that's otherwise permitted by applicable law. Just some clarification of, can I do stuff that's not illegal, or can I do stuff that's not illegal as long as I get the individual's, I take those steps in 6? Did that question make any sense at all? It was unclear to me upon reading whether you could do anything that the anything that the consumer agreed to as long as you'd given the minimum information, or the prior point, point 5, saying, or you can do anything that the law, that's not illegal. So I was just looking for some clarification.
So you can do anything that's permitted by applicable law. So for example, if you're covered under your business associate, you can exchange for, or you can reuse and disclose the data for all of TPO as opposed to the narrow set of P&O that we have in the exchange purposes. But if you wanted, research would still fall outside of the scope, I believe, Catherine.
But I guess that's my perfect example. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think the intent is, just because you tell an individual and they consent to it and it's illegal, that's definitely not the intent. I think, Zoe, what you're trying to articulate is, to the extent that the use, if you want to use research as an example, if it's permitted under HIPAA, to the extent you get the patient's permission, I mean, that still applies. But if there's other uses, TPO, as TEF doesn't include all of them. I mean, if it's already allowed under law, that law kind of prevails over this agreement. I think that the goal is, as I think, Zoe, you alluded to at the beginning, the intent was to zone in on areas that seem to be more, controversial, problematic, where we can try to standardize in some of the areas. And it's not to inhibit other exchanges that folks want to participate in just because it's not included in the agreement. Definitely to clarify, if that's at all helpful. I think in the future, we definitely don't want to send the intent of, just because you got someone's permission, you're able to do stuff that's not in accordance with law.
So per the approach that Arian described in the beginning, I'm trying to avoid engaging in the discussion. I'd still offer that there's some questions to be asked there.
Yeah, and this question is purely for the purposes of just making sure I understand this provision. So there may be actors that act on behalf of the individual that are participants under the TEF or are QHINs under the TEF, deliver their data to the individual under the right of individual access, and then the individual subsequently makes a determination about what they do and don't want to do. Under what cases would these provisions apply, and under what if you understand what I mean, there are these boundary conditions where sometimes I'm acting in role one and sometimes I'm acting in role two. Does that question make sense? And you know, I've got a specific example that if I'm a fruit company, as an example, and I do activity as a fruit company, both under the TEF as a participant and or as a QHIN, and I also build an app that allows the patient to make individual determinations about what they want to do on their data. At which points am I operating under the TEF and subject to these rules, and which points am I acting purely on behalf of the individual?
I would, this is David, I would ask Arian's question in a similar way, contrast the constraints if I'm an individual and I choose to use the APIs required under the data blocking rule and download my data directly from a provider. How does the constraints of that access channel to my data differ from this access channel to my data going through a TEF? Are there differences? Is this put additional constraints that says if you get the data through the TEF, you have to abide by these additional constraints that would not apply if you just got the data directly from your provider with API? And by the way, I think these are good constraints. I like this. I'm just trying to understand where they apply and where they don't apply.
That's right.
Okay, so do we want to continue the discussion, or should we keep trying to go through?
Keep going.
Well, yeah.
Okay. Raise the question. That's important.
Okay. All right. So if you go to the next slide. Okay. So first, we include notifications requirements around breach notification. That apply to all QHINs participants and participant members as if they apply to all of EHI. And we point specifically to 45 CFR Part 164 Subpart D, as well as 45 CFR 164.304, and also include anybody who has an obligation under the FTC rule with respect to any breach of security must also continue to comply with the FTC rule. And then there's also a law enforcement exception to the breach notification. So if, the QHIN participant or participant member is notified by any law enforcement official that a breach, would impede a criminal investigation, then the QHIN shall delay the notification for the time period specified by law enforcement. All right, the next section is meaningful choice, which is actually found in section 2 instead of 6. But meaningful choice is a concept that applies, it's specific to the MRTC, so it's not something from HIPAA. But it is essentially, in layman's terms, although we don't call it an opt-out, it is essentially a blanket opt-out of having the individual's data used and disclosed via the network. And whomever has the direct relationship with the patient, so whether it's the QHIN participant or participant member who's ever providing those services to the patient, has a responsibility to provide the patient with the opportunity to exercise their meaningful choice and also to display on their website instructions for how the individual can go about exercising their meaningful choice.
Quick question there, and I, maybe David will ask exactly the same question I'm going to ask, so I'll just defer to David.
Oh, I just want to register that we need clarity on when meaningful choice might not apply. For example, for direct treatment, is that clearly called out as an exemption, or is this actually change HIPAA rules?
This is over and above HIPAA,
yes,
right?
Correct. It is not called out as an exemption unless something like not exchanging it would be, violation of law. There are currently no other exceptions to meaningful choice.
Go ahead, David. Sorry.
Oh, I got lost in the double negatives there, or when it sounded like that. If I meaningfully choose to opt out of my QHIN data sharing, does that stop any direct treatment sharing that HIPAA would allow?
It would stop anything that's not explicitly required by applicable law. So that's stronger than just being permitted by applicable law. So I believe the answer to your question is yes.
Yes, right. And then just as a clarifying question, the notion of meaningful choice was, I think, introduced by the privacy and security Tiger team, although Devin may have taken it from someplace else. And the notion wasn't simply the ability to opt out, but the notion that rights and choice must be actually explained to the patient. And this is in accordance also with the information blocking exceptions. So do I have that right that not only this is not I need to offer an opt out, and if I offer an opt out, everything's okay. This is, as a QHIN, I must make sure that my participants let their patients know that they're participating, help them understand what that participation is and isn't, and give them the opportunity to give them the choice to participate or not participate based on the information that's been provided to them. Do I have that right?
Yeah, I think that is the intent, and we sort of combine the meaningful choice with the written privacy summary. So like ideally, the entity would receive the written privacy summary explaining all of the rights for privacy, and that would also include the instructions for how to exercise their meaningful choice. But we would love recommendation for if we didn't quite hit the mark, or if we need to be more explicit in terms of like how this is communicated to patients to really make it clear that they need to have this meaningful ability to understand what's happening with their data.
This is Mark. Back to David's question, I just want to confirm if someone exercises meaningful choice and you've got direct treatment, you wouldn't be able to use the QTF for direct treatment, but you would still have the other mechanisms available, right? The meaningful choice is only with respect to the QTF.
Or to the MRTCs or the common agreement,
right,
as a whole.
Right.
If you have an outside, a BAA that allows for that exception, then yeah, you could continue exchanging through that other contracting vehicle.
Right. Okay.
But so this is David. I think that's very unclear in the current document as to, the sort of the boundaries of what you can meaningfully opt out of for sharing. So I would just register that
tag that as a
very concrete examples. Yeah, specifically around direct treatment.
Yep.
And then I want to just register a secondary point that we don't need to talk about now, but sharing the privacy preferences of an individual's meaningful choice action across a network in a robust way is not a very well-solved technical problem. So just register that this is a challenging requirement to meet technically.
Yes, definitely. Go ahead.
No, Aaron just has his hand up as well.
I do. I have a few questions, actually, if that's okay, if you guys can entertain me for a few minutes here. So my first question is related to meaningful choice, as related to, can I opt out as a patient? Is it opt out of everything, or can I actually opt out of a way of the data being used? Let me give you an example for research purposes. If I don't want my data being used for research, but I want it being used for clinical treatment purposes, does that apply, or is it all or nothing? Let me ask that first question.
The way it's currently written, it's all or nothing.
Okay. So that would need to be clear. Number two, related to breach notification, it's quite possible that these various QHINs, or whatever we're calling it now, could reside in different states, which have different state jurisdiction related to breach timing, whatever else, 30 days, 60 days notification, those sorts of things. I understand we say here we got to meet all applicable law. That's totally fine. What about local law? Does this federal law supplant or replace the need for individual QHINs to know their local laws as well?
No, absolutely not. So all applicable law includes all local, state, and federal law.
Right. And then three, related to mental health and substance abuse, how is that differentiated or bifurcated when it comes to choice and that sort of that meaningful choice? Is there granular level consent needed to be given as related to substance and mental health abuse? Because as you know, even in a clinical treatment purposes, you have to explicitly state you want that to be shared, even for treatment purposes. So how does that impact by meaningful choice? Is it all or nothing there as well, or is that another level of differentiation we need to think about?
Currently, as it stands, it is all or nothing. However, we are asking for recommendations and comments around standards for security, tagging, and confidentiality codes, as well as a good format for communicating a meaningful choice between the QHINs. And I think hopefully, as evolve and as we start to work with the industry on more granular requirements in the QTF, that's something that we're looking towards including. But I'll defer to Alex. I think you talked about the security labeling.
Let's just placeholder that one as a discussion point. I see that Mark has his hand up.
Just checking, because I've seen this issue. If the individual exercises her meaningful choice somewhere midway and there's already some data being exchanged, is this draft clear about what happens with the data that's already in the system?
Yes. So meaningful choice is only on a prospective basis. So anything that's already been used or disclosed prior to the exercise of meaningful choice can continue to be used or disclosed.
So it's not just a statement that it cannot be purged from the system. You're actually allowed to continue using it.
It's a prospective choice.
But that also would interfere with any kind of right to be forgotten components down the road. So
yeah.
I'll flag
the question, Arian. What's prospective? Because you could say that the future use of prior data is a prospective choice. So it seems like there may be some clarity that's helpful there.
Okay,
great. All right. Moving on to the next provision is minimum necessary. So this one applies, again, to all QHINs participants and participant members, regardless of whether or not they are business associates or corporate entities. And we specifically reference 45 CFR 164.514D. And we include exceptions that are set forth under the HIPAA rules, including disclosure of PHI to a request by a healthcare provider for treatment. disclosure to an individual who's the subject of the information, disclosure pursuant to an individual's authorization, or disclosures that are required by law. Any questions on minimum necessary? All right, next slide, please. Okay, 6.1.4, 7.4, and 8.4, titled Other Legal Requirements. We could probably come up with a better name for it, but it mainly has to deal, it has to do with like local consent and like local opt-in, opt-out. So basically whoever has the direct relationship with the patient, whether it's the QHIM participant or participant member, is responsible for obtaining and maintaining copies of the individual's consent, approval, or other documentation when required by applicable law. So if you have a state like Rhode Island that's opt-in, the doctor that sees the patient in Rhode Island would have to have the copy of their consent, and they would be responsible for communicating that through to, you know, the applicable participant in QHIN. Okay. Next, we have the written privacy summary, which. Again, if you are an EQHIM participant or participant member that offers services to an individual, must publish and make publicly available a written notice in plain language that describes their privacy practices regarding the access exchange, use and disclosure of EHI. And the written privacy summary should essentially model the ONC model privacy notice that we have on our website, and it should include a description, including at least one example of each type of exchange purpose that the entity offers. So, you know, if you're a participant and you offer individual access services and maybe quality assessment and improvement, then you would make it clear that those are the two, you know, use cases that you're offering. It should include a description that provides the individual with a reasonable understanding of how to exercise their meaningful choice. So it should have the instructions for how they can do that. And it should include contact information for who the individual can contact for more information on the privacy policies. And again, this does not supplant the requirement to do a notice of privacy practices that meets the requirements of HIPAA. And then finally, the last one is a summary of disclosures, which is our take on the accounting of disclosures requirement in HIPAA. And it's essentially the same as the accounting of disclosure requirement at 45 CFR 164.528. And it includes all of the same exceptions that are in there. So there are exceptions for treatment, payment, operations, for an individual, for an individual getting his or her own EHI, an exception if there's an authorization under 45 CFR 164.508, and if there are any correctional or law enforcement reasons or national security or intelligence purposes for not providing the summary of disclosures.
Question?
Go ahead.
It may be clearer in the text, and I don't have in front of me at the moment, but the disclosures happen at multiple levels and layers. So there's a disclosure from the participant to the QHIN. There's a disclosure from the QHIN to another QHIN, and then maybe a disclosure from that QHIN to the participant who did the requesting. To what level does this apply? Is this just the QHIN in and outs, or does it put new rules on the participants?
So the individual can submit a request for their summary of disclosure to the entity with whom they have a direct relationship.
And it would apply to what that individual has disclosed to the QHIN?
To whoever they have the direct relationship with, so whether it's the QHIN participant or participant member.
But not necessarily what happened to it as it flowed down from there or up from there, depending on the topology that you draw.
Maybe to ask David another question another way. Does the accounting disclosure or summary disclosures apply to the activities of the organization to which the patient has a direct relationship and any QHIN that that organization may participate with? Or does that summary of disclosures relate to any activity of any QHIN that's participating in the TEF? Or is that a question that we need to frame up?
I think that's something to flag.
Okay.
And Zoe, I apologize if you covered it. On the summary of disclosures for applicable exchange purposes, is that the same things one would account for disclosures for under HIPAA, or are we saying all exchange purpose transactions, period?
The exchange purposes, the applicable exchange purposes that are relevant in the MRTC.
So if I'm an individual, I have a direct relationship with a participant, any transactions with my data for exchange purposes would be captured in this accounting and disclosure, even for TPO, et cetera, et cetera.
Not for the exception. So there's an exception for TPO. So really, it would only apply for, public health benefits determination and individual.
For the same things one puts in an accounting of disclosure under HIPAA currently?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Here's the language on the screen. It took a minute, but 9.5.3 has all of the exceptions.
Yeah, if I remember correctly, the intent behind this was not to try to broaden HIPAA in this case.
Yeah, that would, in my opinion, be a bad idea, so I like your answer. And then a quick one, I think this is easy, on going back to written privacy summary. Zoe, I understood you to say this does not supplant the need for a HIPAA notice of privacy practices. So does that mean that every covered entity that participates in the TEFCA ecosystem is going to have two privacy notices?
It could mean that, although you could meet the requirements of our written privacy summary. If you have a notice of privacy practice already, then you could use that to meet our requirements.
So you would just modify it to make sure it served both purposes?
Correct.
Got it. Thank you.
Okay. Are we ready to move on to security?
Let's do it.
Alex, it's to you.
Yep, thanks, Zoe. Okay, so number one, minimum security requirements. This is something that Zoe covered a little bit in her introduction to privacy and security. This is one of those cases where we have applied certain requirements to non-HIPAA entities. So just broadly, all QHINs are required to comply with all of the HIPAA privacy and security provisions as if they applied to electronic health information. And participants and participant members who are covered entities or business associates also have to continue to comply with the HIPAA rules that are appropriate to them or applicable to them. However, if you are not a HIPAA entity, so not a covered entity or business associate, we have identified a certain set of security provisions or privacy and security provisions that you have to adhere to, and these do materially align with those found under HIPAA. So it's things like maintaining reasonable and appropriate administrative, technical, physical safeguards, protecting against reasonably anticipated impermissible uses and disclosures, protecting against reasonably anticipated threats to security or integrity of information, monitoring compliance among your workforce, and then also as you determine the appropriate safeguards, each entity should consider things like the its size, complexity, and capabilities, its infrastructure, the cost of security measures, and the likelihood and possible impact of potential risks to electronic health information. Our next provision relates to controlled and classified information, which is a certain category of information that's created by federal agencies. This NIST special publication, 800-171, I believe covers particular security requirements required for entities handling controlled and classified information. And in this case, this provision only applies at the QHIN level. We do not have a parallel provision for participants or participant members.
Quick question there. Many, or at least some, federal agencies treat EHI at higher than controlled and classified. DOD treats PHI as readiness data and appropriate to SRG high. I don't know what VA does with regard to this. So anyway, maybe that's a placeholder for how do we align federal agency information security requirements relative to QHIN requirements?
Yeah, we don't have any specific provisions dealing with, those rules or regulations. So again, I'd point to applicable law and probably something that we might want to flag for further discussion.
Yep.
Okay, electronic health information use and disclosure outside of the United States. So basically, we have a provision here that says that QHINs cannot disclose electronic health information outside of the United States, except as required by applicable law, and if an individual user specifically requires that QHIN to use or disclose their information outside of the United States. There's also a provision in here about cloud-based service providers, which have to be physically located in the United States.
Quick question on that one. Why is this provision particular to cloud-based service providers? If I have a data hosting service or if I own my own hosting facility, can it be located outside the United States?
I don't think we specifically comment on that in this draft, so something to flag.
Okay.
Yeah, you need to define what you mean by cloud-based. You know, something about where the servers are that manage the data or something, rather than a generic term like cloud.
All right, next slide. Data integrity. Okay. So this is another one that applies to all three levels, QIN's participants and participant members. And they all need to include procedures that promote data integrity with respect to the exchange purposes under the framework agreements. There is a list of, I guess, five specific data integrity things that these entities have to account for. So, for example, procedures to safeguard that electronic health information is not improperly altered or destroyed, procedures to protect against reasonably anticipated impermissible uses or disclosures, procedures to maintain backup copies of systems and databases, private keys, software and data corruption, and that's related to performing a role as a certificate authority, procedures to test and restore backup copies of systems, databases, private keys, for the retrieval of data in the event of a disaster, emergency, or any other circumstance requiring the restoration of electronic health information, and procedures to document methodologies and results of tests to restore backup copies of systems, databases, and private keys. And again, this is related to the role of serving as a certificate authority.
Quick question. This sounds to be mostly overlapping with HIPAA security. Was the intent that this was elements that went beyond HIPAA security, or what was the intent?
Zoe, do you have insight?
Well, so it goes beyond in that it applies to all electronic health information, but aside from that, it mirrors what's in HIPAA. One other small nuance that I would say is that I think that for this one, or actually, Alex, I could be wrong. I think this one is you only have to do these processes for the exchange purposes that you
perform, right?
Perform.
So I don't know if this deserves being on the question list, but we've already said that QHINs participants and participant members have to comply with HIPAA security as if it were pertaining to EHI. Did I make that requirement up, or did we say that?
So participants and participant members, if they're not business, if they're not covered entities and business associates, they do not have to comply with all of HIPAA. They only have to comply with the provisions that we put in here.
And we're calling these out here, and that's the whole point.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you.
It's an enumerated list, right, and not the whole law.
Correct. But so the slight nuance that I was getting at a moment ago in that you only have to, for the data integrity provision, and I think it's also the audit provision, which Alex will get to in a minute, you only have to do it for the exchange purposes that you perform. And our intention with saying that is so if we're thinking about a third-party app or a public health registry that really only does one exchange purpose, one use case, then they only need to do the, you know, the data integrity and the auditing requirements for that purpose.
Sorry, we're ready for the next one. Somebody asked me a question.
Yes, please.
Okay, authorization. Not much else in the MRTCs beyond what's written here. QHINs participants and participant members must include policies to obtain written authorization. They have to include written authorization procedures to confirm that any entities requesting access to system functions or electronic health information possess the appropriate credentials. So we don't mapping this back to the QTF, we don't necessarily define anything about roles or anything like that. So I guess the general policy here is that if you are a signatory to the common agreement or framework agreements, you are appropriately authorized to access electronic health information.
Does that mean that the definition of appropriately authorized is specified elsewhere, such as in HIPAA or state or local rules?
Referring to some of the common access control concepts of role-based access and things like that. We don't define specific roles.
But you're essentially deferring the notion of what roles are appropriate to other regulatory frameworks, other regulatory constraints. You're not adding any new ones, I get that, but that means it just defaults to what's already there.
Correct. Or if, for example, an organization delegates certain roles or authority under its own purview.
I don't know if anybody else agrees with this, but it strikes me that I understand why you've pulled out specific security requirements to make it a subset of HIPAA, but the nice thing about referring to HIPAA specifically is that there's a whole bunch of collateral and definitions and experience that everybody knows what that means. And so kind of to David's point, or if I'm not bastardizing it, is that to pull these requirements out freestanding, I'm not sure how clear it's going to be for compliance.
Well, this is David.
That certainly is a
fair statement of my concern, but I think the context that it makes some sense to do what they did is that not everybody will otherwise be subject to HIPAA. So you have to either re-enumerate them or make them subject to HIPAA, I'm guessing, from just a regulatory framework point of view.
Or and I'm not sure what I'm saying makes sense, but as a compromise, to do a whole bunch of this thing just like in HIPAA and that thing just like in HIPAA, without having to, incorporate HIPAA security chunks by reference.
By reference,
Yeah, it would be useful if I'm already subject to HIPAA to be able just to defer.
But it's the place where this will matter is those non-covered entities that choose to participate in the QHIN will now have some new burdens placed on them, and it needs to be pretty clear what those things mean. The HIPAA world figured it out over.
Completely understand and concur with that. I'm just trying to avoid having to have double F compliance efforts.
Yeah, total. Agree.
Yeah, and just to be clear, this particular provision, and I believe some of the ones coming next, I don't believe that they're actually covered in the HIPAA security rule. So if I'm wrong about that, please correct me. But this isn't referring to like a HIPAA patient authorization or anything like that.
Right. No, got it.
Okay. Identity proofing. This is based on the NIST standards. There's a suite of three guidance technical documents related to identity management. And so the requirement here is that essentially all entities have to be identity proofed at the NIST Identity Assurance Level 2 requirements. Right, next slide. Authentication is pretty similar to identity proofing. also relying on the NIST standards and requires all entities to be authenticated at the authentication assurance level 2 requirements.
This is David. I ought to know the answer to this, but I'm not sure I do. And maybe, Arian, you are closer. Would you think that these last two requirements introduce new burdens compared to what participants in things like Commonwealth and Care Quality are already doing, or are these just consistent with that?
I'm a little confused by NIST level 2. I thought that NIST went to changed its terminology in later guidance. And this is specific to identity assurance and not authentication. So it might just be worthwhile being referring to the exact sections of the exact guidance, rather than say something like, and I assume you guys do that in the actual text.
No, we do actually just refer to the guidance overall. I believe what you're talking about is that NIST originally had a sort of overarching assurance level, and the change was that they broke it down into these three subcomponents, identity, authentication, and I think maybe authorization. I'm not sure what the third is.
863/3, is that right? Is that the latest?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And if I'm remembering... Go ahead.
My question was simply, is this an impactful change, or is this just codifying existing best practices? And I'm not expert enough to know. We would have to seek input from...
Yeah, so sorry, you're talking about AAL2, which is authentication. IAL is identity proofing, and I want to make sure that we understand what we're talking about.
Correct.
Well,
so which one are we talking about?
So IAL would be the identity proofing requirement, yeah, and AAL2 would be the authentication requirement.
So I have a comment about identity proofing, which is that if I remember correctly, participants can accept the identity proofing of participant members, and QHINs can accept the identity proofing of participants. Is that correct?
Zoe, do you know the answer to that?
Yeah, it's exactly. So, like, the QHIN is responsible for identity proofing the participants. Participants are responsible for identity proofing participant members.
I think it was
as long as somebody in the tree has done the appropriate identity proofing, everybody else can trust it. Is a better way to say.
As long as you're doing the appropriate, as long as you're authenticating at the appropriate level. So IAL2 is real world identity proofing, and David, I think that's consistent with Commonwealth. AAL2 is two factor.
Yeah, and the AAL2 may be where there's more concern. Does that apply to individual access and where two-factor might not be currently in place? I think it should be, frankly. I'm totally in agreement with this, but I'm just, I guess it would be worth looking for comments as to
yep.
Would it be disruptive to existing practices, and if so, is it justified?
Right, and identity proofing is more of a one-time event prior to issuance of credentials, whereas authentication is something that has to happen on any request for electronic health information or request to send electronic health information.
Okay, keep going, please.
All right, transport security. So again, all QHINs participants and participant members must have written policies and procedures to ensure secure channel for communications with other entities. and mapping this back to the QN technical framework, we have a requirement to use TLS. Or proposed a requirement to use TLS.
Nobody is not in favor of TLS. But with what crypto algorithm? Sorry.
Yeah, right. Which version?
1.1, 1.2, which crypto algorithms are included? Sorry, let's please not include this in let's make this defer all these naughty issues.
Arian, you're just showing off.
I am. It's true.
There's another NIST document, I believe, that's included in the QTF. It's sort of a best practices document, or maybe it's an IETF document. I'm not 100% sure off the top of my head, but it does provide a little bit more clarification beyond the broad use of TLS. And I think we also versioned the use of TLS in the QTF.
Yeah.
Okay, moving on to auditable events. This one's a little complicated because it sort of has a little mini flowdown baked in. Because QHIN has to in its, or all QHINs in its security policy have to identify a set of auditable events. And then the participants and participant members essentially pick from those auditable events with appropriate modifications based on the transactions that they perform.
Let's flag this one for discussion, because I think it's odd to have MRTCs that refer to QTFs that will change.
Fair enough. And there's also in this provision some of the minimum information that an audible event must include, such as the description of the event, date and time, success and failure, and then where appropriate, the entity that was responsible for the event.
And just so I'm clear,
David,
go ahead, David. You're probably going to ask the same question.
Trying to relate this to the accounting for disclosure requirements, auditable for whose review and under what circumstances. Linking those together seems reasonable to understand who gets to see these auditable events.
Right. So there is some language in here that the entities must maintain an audit log, including records of all of these events, and must make it available during any audit.
By the RCE,
who's doing the audits?
Not specified, so something to flag, perhaps.
Yeah.
Okay, next slide. Security policies. So each QN certificate policies. Each QN security policy has to require that all participant certificates meet or exceed applicable criteria. The QTF does not have very extensive criteria at this point. We didn't necessarily want to dictate how security or certificates were assigned and distributed in this network.
Yeah. Okay. So we talked about individual identity assurance. We haven't talked about organizational identity assurance. Do the MRTCs talk about organizational identity assurance? Because that tends to be actually much more important.
I believe that the NIST specification applies to both. But again,
yeah, let's just flag this one. Yeah.
And this is David. I agree that this details of this should be deferred to the RCE and the stakeholders, but we'll caution that it's a thorny area when you bring federal partners in and mix networks. Just historically, it's been sometimes more complicated than you might expect to get agreement on certificate policies.
Okay, security authority backup and recovery. So each QHIN who issues certificates must maintain backup copies of systems, databases, and private keys in order to rebuild the certificate authority's capability in the event of software or data corruption. This should not be read to imply that a QHIN has to issue certificates, just in the event that they do.
I think it is an extraordinarily bad practice even to include this section, so just flagging this one for note.
All right, finally, we have security labeling. Let me just... So this is not included in the MRTCs at this point. This is part of the introductory language. We did include a proposal related to security labeling that we are requesting comment on. And basically, the idea here is that in a future iteration of TEFCA, data holders would have to apply security labels for any electronic health information that includes codes from value sets indicating one of three categories of sensitive information: mental health, substance use disorder, and HIV. Additionally, all electronic health information pertaining to minor patients would have to be labeled.
By the way, I'm looking at NIST SP 863A, and it does not refer, to the extent that I can identify, to organizational identity assurance. It really talks about applicants, biometrics, and the like. So just as a point that I think we need to talk about organizational identity assurance.
Go ahead, David.
Well, just a question on the security labeling. I didn't pick up when I read the document that you're saying this is preamble but not part of the actual MRTCs. Does that mean it would be deferred to the RCE to work out in the future in conjunction with ONC? Is that the intent? Security labeling?
Correct. I believe, Zoe, correct me if I'm wrong, based on comments that we get, this might be incorporated into a future version of the MRTCs. So that wouldn't necessarily involve the RCE establishing a policy, but ONC establishing a policy.
That's exactly right, Alex. So if it's in the MRTCs, that means ONC established the policy. If it's in the ARTCs, then the RCE wrote it. So I'd say we reserve the right before we get into full common agreement, but, you know, after this public comment period, to add something about security labeling into the MRTCs.
And just from my own understanding, I did not hear you reference compliance with CUI as a reason for security labeling. Is that not one of the reasons for this? I want to make sure I'm not connecting two things inappropriately.
Correct. That would not be a requirement under the proposed policy.
But you're asking for, you listed a bunch of proposed categories for which security labeling might be useful in the future, but I didn't hear you say CUI. My understanding is that part of the challenge of organizations complying with the appropriate NIST standards is figuring out how to security label the data. I might be confused.
No, that's correct. The proposed policies do not make reference to CUI, and from my understanding, one of the issues surrounding CUI is labeling. So maybe something to flag as another potential use case for this security labeling policy.
And this is David. On that thought, I like the idea of separating labeling from actually respecting what those labels imply that you do, but I would caution you that without going that second step, you might not have achieved a whole lot of good. So at some point, you have to actually say you have to handle this labeled data in special ways, not just label it. And that's the hard part is you know, governing secondary use of the data or even secondary redisclosure or things like that, 42 CFR2 and stuff like that. The easy part is labeling. The hard part is figuring out what the rules are about what you must do to respect those labels. But separating it into two steps makes a lot of sense to me.
And I see that we're being gently reminded that we've reached public comment.
Yes, yep. Thank you. Operator, can you go to public comment, please?
If you'd like to make a public comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. A confirmation tone will indicate your line is in the queue. You may press star 2 if you'd like to move your comment from the queue. For participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing the star keys.
Do we have anybody waiting in the line for public comment?
Not at the moment.
Okay. John and Arian?
So just a time check and progress check. Is it reasonable or is it rational to try and circle back to stuff like modalities and exchange purposes to add items to the list for prioritization, or how do you want to use the remaining time?
Did we get through all the privacy and security requirements?
We did.
Okay. What I'd propose, since we only have six more minutes, is that we end a little bit early. We've got some follow-up time, and I'd propose that we assemble a list of high priority items and then review them with this group tomorrow. Maybe solicit a call for this issue is burning so hard in my pocket that I can barely stand. If you've got some things that you don't think that we're sufficiently aware of, otherwise I just propose that we review the list of high priority topics and with the team tomorrow, and then get agreement that that's the right list, and then we prioritize that list and work through and chunk through in priority order.
Sounds like a good plan.
Okay.
Sounds good. And that list, Arian, will include past items too. This is really helpful to see the discussion notes on the right, so just checking.
Yeah, no, the discussion notes is a great practice that we should have been doing a while back, but we'll continue to do.
So we need to capture previous items and add them to this list is what I heard.
That's right.
Yes, please. Individual access services for me, at least.
Yep, and I assume David will concur with me that the overall architecture of Exchange, the specifics of the QTF also need discussion. We've also heard about the role of, and this may be individual access services, but the role of individual intermediaries and their obligations.
Yep.
And I think the secondary use question around, secondary use, maybe we talked about some of those questions, but there was another one about reciprocality of an aggregator of patient data.
Yep.
That was an unanswered question, like what duties do they have to not respond, or can they opt out of responding if they have
aggregated? That's right. So do we have the right bundling of exchange modalities? We had some flags for discussion of directed exchange or pushed exchange, and the obligations of QHINs to do those. And I'm still just confused by when and in what circumstances are QHINs required to do all exchange modalities as opposed to part of exchange modalities. So we got a lot to discuss. We're going to go offline, assemble a list, and then review that with this team tomorrow.
Great. Thanks so much.
Thanks all.
Sounds good.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.